Welcome to the Burn Bag Podcast. My name is Ryan Rosenthal, joined as always by my co-host Andre Ganuela. And today we are thrilled to be joined by Glenn Gerstel. Now, Glenn served as the general counsel of the National Security Agency and Central Security Agency from 2015 to 2020. And prior to joining NSA, he practiced law for almost 40 years at the international law firm of Milbank, focusing on global telecommunications industry, and served as managing partner of the DC office, the Singapore office, and the Hong Kong office. So he's been around the world. Glenn also served on the President's National Infrastructure Advisory Council and the DC Homeland Security Commission. He is now a non-resident senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and is a sought-after speaker, advisor, and thought leader on the role of technology in national security, cybersecurity, and geopolitics. Glenn, it is an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Ryan and Andre, thank you both for having me on your podcast. I'm really looking forward to it. I've noticed that you've had a really distinguished lineup of speakers before me, so I hope I rise to the occasion here. But I commend you for doing this, and I know we're going to have a great conversation.
Thank you so much, Glenn. We are going to have a great conversation. And first, I want to dig into disinformation. So you've recently made a lot of media appearances. You've written some articles on this topic, and it's become abundantly clear that our adversaries are using social media against us. Disinformation, it's an incredible challenge and one that seemingly lacks clear solutions. So how do you view the threat of disinformation, and what solutions do you actually see as being the most realistic or feasible?
Andre, that's a great question to start the ball rolling here. So you certainly didn't start with an easy pitch. I would open up by simply saying I think disinformation is actually a national security problem. I say that because let's take two of the crises confronting us right now, which is our political polarization and the pandemic. When we have a situation in which, due to disinformation, online disinformation, we're basically talking about cyber-propelled online disinformation, when we have a situation in which at least as of recent polling, some significant percentage of people still question the legitimacy of the last presidential election. Apparently, more Republicans than Democrats, but whatever the number is, it apparently is depending upon which poll you read, somewhere between 10 to potentially 30% of the people question the legitimacy of the last presidential election. That can't be healthy for a democracy. That can't be good for our ability to come together to solve the many pressing problems we have. And in terms of the pandemic, we've all seen the disinformation online surrounding vaccinations, the need to wear masks, reputing scientific facts about how masks can limit the transmission of disease, the effectiveness of vaccines, so on and so forth. And again, if that's going to create a situation in which we do not get the vast majority of our country, up to 70, 80, 90% of our people immunized, then we're going to continue to have to live with the pandemic and its economic and social consequences as a result. And again, that is just not good for our national security. So there are two areas in which online disinformation spread both domestically and by foreign adversaries greatly affects our national well-being. And if that's not a definition of national security, then I don't know what is.
Can't argue with that. And so, Glenn, there's a lot of issues to unpack here, but I want to start with talking about quote unquote fake news, right? I mean, disinformation is nothing new. I mean, it was in the Cold War, it's up to today. And so the impact in particular we saw in 2016 with the role of mass media, but I'm curious how the government's approach changed in 2020 and if we learned any valuable lessons. You, of course, were at NSA in that kind of crucial time period.
Yes, Ryan. So you touched on a couple of points there. Let me just pick up a couple. You opened up by noting that disinformation has been around for a long time, and that's of course certainly true. Maybe spreading lies is the second oldest profession, perhaps. I think what we've seen is that cyber-enabled, cyber-propelled disinformation is very different from just simply the old-fashioned spreading of propaganda lies or puffery about a country. So when I was a kid, we were always worried about the propaganda from the Soviet Union and the communists and so on and so forth. And we all knew what propaganda was when we saw it. It was just out. It was just sort of outrageous puffery or deliberate lies. But it was all designed to sort of bolster the other country's position. And it wasn't particularly done with malice necessarily directly, a desire to actually feed erroneous information with a malicious input. And while I think it would be very hard to define the line between disinformation and propaganda or puffery, it's a little bit like the famous saying about obscenity, you sort of, you know it when you see it. So I think we can all point to certain statements that would clearly fall into the category of malicious disinformation, information intended to be spread, intended to be viewed as reliable for the purpose of changing some outcome. And that outcome could simply be sowing discourse. It could be actually altering the course of specific events. During the last election, to get to that specific question, during the last election in 2016, our nation was caught flat-footed. We were the victim of a very significant, serious, sustained campaign by the Russians to interfere in our elections using some tools available to them online, mostly through Facebook and Twitter. All of this was documented in a bipartisan 5-volume study of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. This is not something that's still in dispute. This is, again, a bipartisan committee looked at the 2016 election and said, there's no question but that Russia sought to influence that election. Now, we could debate over some niceties as to whether that meant they were supporting Trump or they were against Hillary or whatever, but we could go back and forth over those distinctions. But clearly Russia was making a genuine attempt to be involved in our election, not necessarily to affect vote totals or the tabulation of votes, but clearly to try to get involved in our public discourse in our democracy. When it came time to 2018, and I was at the National Security Agency at that time, we had learned our lesson and took very assertive action to make sure that Russians or other countries did not interfere in the midterm elections. And with the help of our military partner at the National Security Agency, which is the United States Cyber Command, which is co-located with it in Fort Meade in Maryland, just outside Washington. And when it came time for the 2020 elections, which the Departments of Homeland Security and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence of others have said were the safest in our history in terms of freedom from online foreign influence and foreign interference, I think we should feel pretty good about it. We didn't see any evidence of anyone changing any vote totals, anyone getting involved in altering the balloting, the tabulation of ballots, etc. There was still some misinformation spread online from foreign countries as well as domestically, and in some ways, perhaps the domestic problem is one that is more acute right now than the foreign one.
So when we talk about the domestic problem versus the foreign problem, so I mean, in 2016, it's pretty widely accepted, or so it seems, that Russia was the primary perpetrator of all this election-related disinformation. But what about 2020? I mean, was Russia still as deeply engaged in peddling this disinformation, or were there more domestic actors who were more particularly active? Like, were they more active to a higher degree in terms of originating and then spreading this disinformation, or was it still the Russians?
Well, Russia was still involved, and they still had some attempts at spreading both misinformation and disinformation in the 2020 election. No sign that they sought to get involved in interfering, as opposed to influencing, interfering in election machinery. But it looked like most of the researchers who've studied social media and the general question of online disinformation have concluded that the disinformation that existed around the 2020 elections was mostly domestically produced. And there are some studies that show that there are a number of Facebook pages and Twitter accounts that had far more forwardings and social and interactions with people liking it, forwarding it, commenting on it than other pages. And most of those were domestically produced. They tended to be on the political right, on the Republican side, on the far right. And maybe there are some reasons for that. We could, you know, there are some suggestions in the academic literature as to why people on the right are more prone to conspiracy theories, and more receptive to disinformation. Perhaps it has to do with a sense of aggrievement. Perhaps we could sort of psychoanalyze it, so to speak. But the fact of the matter is that disinformation works when it falls on receptive ears. If you aren't inclined to believe something, if you aren't already suspicious of the Democrats, for example, then the allegation that they're Democrats are running a child sex ring isn't going to resonate with you. But if you really think that Democrats are evil people, well, that maybe you might be more prone to accept that.
So, Glenn, we keep kind of circling around the issue of actually meddling in the election infrastructure, because that was a concern in 2016. But the recently released National Intelligence Council report on the foreign threats to the 2020 election highlighted that while there were influence operations by Russia and Iran, there were no noted attempts at infiltrating the actual infrastructure. And so why do you think that our adversaries did not actually attempt to quote unquote hack into the elections and change the actual results in 2020, or maybe not do so as far as we know?
Well, I'm pretty confident that we do know, and we do know that they were not successful, indeed did not even have any serious attempts at changing vote totals, changing the way tabulation occurs, or otherwise interfering in the actual election machinery itself. and I think there are basically two reasons for that. One, we took steps over the last few years to greatly upgrade the cybersecurity of our election machinery, and we made it more resilient. We have paper backups. We've got other ability to audit and verify and confirm that there hasn't been some kind of cyber chicanery associated with it. And to the credit of the Department of Homeland Security and the states who actually run the election machinery, they did a pretty good job in greatly increasing where they were just a few short years ago, their overall cybersecurity posture. And that surely had an effect. There's still a long way to go. It's going to take a lot of money and years before we really get all of our election machinery to the level of cybersecurity that we know it should be. But the far more significant reason I don't think we saw that is I think our foreign adversaries concluded that the risk of getting caught in interfering with our democratic election machinery is not worth it to them. Let's take China, one of our most capable adversaries in the cyber realm. From China's point of view, they're interested in promoting the view that China is a good partner. And in Asia, they call themselves a good neighbor. They have a good neighbor campaign in Asia. And throughout the last couple of years, they've been trying to promote themselves as having a superior form of government, which is doing all sorts of benevolent things. They were quick to seize upon the fact that they were providing medical supplies to Italy during the height of the pandemic, and et cetera. And if they were caught interfering with the democratic machinery of the United States, wow, that would give the lie to their argument that they're a good neighbor. So they can't possibly take that risk from their reputational point of view. And God knows they don't want to jeopardize their trade with the United States, which I think, if I remember correctly, accounts for something on the order of 17% of their economy. So they are not going to take that risk. That is just not worthwhile to them. And I think a similar calculation was involved for Russia, although they are far more immune to damage to the trade. They don't have much trade with us in the first place. It's a very tiny economy. Russia's a country with the GDP of Illinois and Pennsylvania combined, so we should remember that. But from their point of view, they know that if they crossed the line and actually interfered with election machinery, that it would probably be viewed very, very seriously by Washington, and there would be serious retaliations beyond just some sanctions, which probably aren't going to hurt them. So again, I think the Kremlin just concluded the likelihood of our being successful and achieving a really different outcome and not getting caught versus the risk of getting caught, a no-brainer. They shouldn't do it.
So when we talk about election infrastructure, though, it seems like so much of election infrastructure is so sort of decentralized, right? Like, I mean, localities and states are governing their own machinery. We have different companies sort of providing these election and ballot machines. So, like, you know, with that in mind, like, how does the U.S. government sort of work in this decentralized way to, like, ensure and guarantee that we have this type of security in place to thwart any future, like, hacking attempts?
Depending upon your point of view, Andre, that could either be one of the benefits of our federal system or one of the annoyances of our federal system. Obviously, the Constitution explicitly leaves to the states the running of elections, and the states in turn, by and large, leave that to each county. So it is a very, very decentralized system. And there are lots of reasons for it. Most elections have to do, I mean, there are far more local officials running than there are just for national office, of course. So it certainly makes sense that you want a significant amount of local control in the area. But I don't necessarily view that as a negative at all, because I think it's important that we have local control of election machinery. And then to the extent that the federal government, whether it's through the Federal Election Assistance Commission or through the Department of Homeland Security, through Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency, can provide guidance to the states, who can then pass it on to their counties, of setting up standards that they need to follow. So maybe it's a little inefficient, but I think it balances the needs of our American federal system. And I do not view that the structure will be an impediment to our getting high quality cybersecurity in our election system.
So, Glenn, we talked about protecting our actual infrastructure, but I want to circle back to the problem of disinformation for a minute, because, you know, the United States government has a lot of capacity. There's a lot of tools available at its disposal, but should it be working more with the private sector or maybe NGOs or the think tank worlds to address disinformation? Is it a regulatory, you know, solution, more cooperation, a combination?
Is there a box for all of the above? Because that's the one that I would check, which is to say, disinformation is a complex problem. The roots of it are obviously political and social on one hand, but also it's technology, because technology enables and propels cyber-propelled disinformation. It makes it, when there's a lie online, we all are sort of attracted to it. That's the social aspect of it. We're more excited by bad news, by lies, by lurid things, by conspiracies. They all sort of sound more exciting than just normal news. So we tend to want to forward that immediately. We want to tend to click like on it. We want to disseminate it. And the technology plays a role in that, of course. The algorithms that feed you the disinformation up front also help propel this. So technology has a piece. As I said, societal factors and political factors have a piece. And certainly government regulation has a piece. Everybody by now has heard these debates over Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which basically gives the social media platforms a freedom from liability for the content posted on them. It also gives them the freedom to take down accounts and not be sued. And many people have said that section of the law, while it made good sense at the dawn of the internet age to help foster the internet, no longer makes sense now when the internet is rife with hate speech, disinformation, et cetera, and we can do a better job online. So I think part of it is maybe amending Section 230 in some reasonable way. We could spend more time on that. There are other factors. We could have international treaties that help minimize foreign election interference. So we could have international norms or treaties that would prevent Russia from interfering in our election. Maybe they'd be enforced, maybe they wouldn't, but maybe they'd be a step in the right direction. We could have more civics education here in the United States. If we had civics education and we did not have statistics such as we now have, which is that some 40% of the people cannot even name the three branches of government, then it's no surprise that we have a lot of people who were very disappointed that Vice President Pence didn't personally alter the Electoral College vote. And if you had taken your civics lessons, you'd know that that was constitutionally impossible. But if you didn't and had no knowledge of how government worked, and President Trump said it would be important for the Vice President to nullify the Electoral College vote, your answer might be, well, yeah, sure. So civics education has a huge role to play. I'm obviously oversimplifying it, but there are many factors here.
So with Section 230, can these tech companies like realistically comply with it? And I guess like for our audience who may not be familiar with Section 230, could you give a brief overview of what it is?
Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act was enacted several decades ago at the dawn of the internet age. It was designed to foster what was then a brand new technology. We wanted to coddle it a little bit. It was our new baby. We were marveling at it, and our country decided we were going to make sure it didn't get ensnared in lawsuits and civil litigation. And the way to do that, unlike what we do for newspapers and magazines and other publications, is to give it immunity for the content that it carries. So more specifically, if someone were to post an illegal statement online on YouTube, on Twitter, on Facebook, those social media platforms would not be responsible and could not be legally liable for it. But of course, the person who perpetrated it would be, but not the social media platform. And similarly, the social media platform said, look, we want the ability to take down accounts that disagree with our terms of service, and we don't want to be sued by them and caught up in lawsuits. So they have special immunity for taking actions in deleting content. And at the time, this made sense. It gave the social media platforms a little bit of breathing room to develop into what they are, which is extraordinarily unbelievable, with Facebook having literally billions of users around the world and somewhat comparable numbers for YouTube and Twitter, not quite as large, obviously. So it may have made sense at the beginning, but right now, with so much misinformation and disinformation spread online, and to go back to my earlier comment, it has become a national security problem for us to have information about elections and the state of our political society and the health of our country with the pandemic. It makes no sense to allow a system to exist where someone can get away with saying, I'm sorry, I'm just not responsible for it. That's someone else's problem. That doesn't make sense to me in our democracy.
So with the dangers that we've been discussing, I think really one of the primary challenges is how difficult it is to spot disinformation, to spot fake news. And right, there's all these tools that we can put in place in order to kind of increase education so that more Americans and people around the world can be aware. And so Glenn, if you were designing a program, how can you help Americans protect themselves against fake news? What sort of tools should they look for, or what can they do to kind of educate themselves?
As I said earlier, I think disinformation is something you sort of know it when you see it. And the proof of that is there are a fair number of organizations that I think are quite independent and quite transparent. NewsGuard is one of them that comes to mind, but there are others that have as their role trying to assess the level of veracity or level of misinformation online. And so NewsGuard specifically goes around and flags sites that are spreading factually incorrect information. So I think it's fairly easy to identify sites that are spreading false information. Yes, of course, there are borderline questions. And yes, of course, there's gray areas, and people are certainly allowed to express their opinion. But I don't think that's really what we're worried about. What we're really worried about are the very, very serious attempts to spread erroneous information with malice. Either people who are wholesale fabricating something and making some conspiracy theory up out of whole, you know, just thin air, or otherwise forwarding factually incorrect information. I think most people, if they're careful, are able to spot the difference. And to their credit, finally, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, others are now finally over the past, largely the last year, really taking great efforts to use their own automated systems to take down fake accounts, to strike out disinformation when it is online. There are, as I said, there are other systems one can look at to provide external validation. And so before you click forward on something that seems too crazy to be true, maybe it's worth checking it for a second.
Certainly. But, you know, Glenn, we've talked a lot about election interference, and certainly our government and our public, we were very geared towards, you know, addressing election interference in the run-up to November. But, you know, while we were geared towards election interference, Russia was doing a whole other thing with the SolarWinds hack into all of the US government agencies and other sorts of companies and other entities. And I mean, some have called it the most significant hack in US history. And it certainly highlights many great vulnerabilities for the US. But what exactly did we miss? Like, how was Russia able to get such access into these systems used by governments and contractors? Like, were we just like not ready for it? Was our government's focus just not there? Like, what was sort of going on, I guess?
Sure. The SolarWinds hack was certainly a very, very significant issue for us and is perhaps a tipping point in our reaction in terms of how we address cybersecurity here in the United States. But first, I want to make clear something you alluded to in your question, Andre, which is I don't think we were making a mistake by having the intelligence community and our departments of Homeland Security and others zealously focused on election security. That was the right thing for us. And I don't think it's a zero-sum game. I don't think we missed SolarWinds because of that. We missed SolarWinds hack for other reasons. So number one, I think we were doing the right thing. It's not an either or. The SolarWinds hack was very different from prior hacks. It relied on a so-called supply chain hack, where basically Russia took advantage of a normal update in SolarWinds software. SolarWinds manufactures some software that is used for internet management by many, many, many companies. It has tens of thousands of customers in government and industry throughout the United States. And it injected some malware into their ordinary updates. The analogy I would use is if you could imagine that you were opening the door to let someone in your home who was a painter who was coming to paint your house, and he brought an assistant with him, and the assistant didn't look anything suspicious to you, just same came into your house, nothing unusual to look at there, unbeknownst to you, and indeed unbeknownst to the painter, which is in this case was SolarWinds, the assistant had a nefarious purpose in mind and went around to the back door of your house and unlocked it for future access and left it that way. So what I mean by that in this case is SolarWinds was not aware that it's perfectly legitimate updates, which are routine, had embedded in it this piece of Russian malware. And then so we do not have in the systems that protect the United States government, which is a computerized sort of firewall system called Einstein, the ability to in effect peer inside an update and look at it to say, gee, that update is correct, it doesn't have anything bad in it. That's a known deficiency of the Einstein system. People have known about it. We had been hoping all along that no one would take advantage of that, but here someone finally did. And then once inside the system, while it's probably the case that with better cybersecurity protocols, we could have curtailed the scope of what the Russians did once they were inside computers. I mean, and various victims had various levels of penetration depending upon how carefully or how sloppily they configured their internal systems. Again, it was not the kind of thing that we had really built our cybersecurity defenses for. I think, again, like all of these times, you learn your lesson, and we're now more focused on it. I think it also reveals a gap in our authorities, which is that the way Russia was able to control the malware once it was injected into the SolarWinds customers was through a computer server, a virtual server that they leased perfectly legitimately from GoDaddy, which is a very popular web hosting service. Completely legitimately used US infrastructure as the command and control vehicle to control the software that was this malicious software that was located in 9 federal governments and many, many companies. And yet, the United States government does not have the ability, as a general matter, to do cyber surveillance domestically. We do cyber surveillance overseas through the NSA, through CIA, others, but we do not do that for perfectly good Fourth Amendment and policy reasons, but we do not do that generally in the United States. So there's a gap, and our adversaries know about that gap. Russia and China take advantage of the fact that they can lease infrastructure, communications infrastructure here in the United States, perfectly legally, and use it as a base to mount their attacks. A big gap in our authorities.
So Glenn, I certainly want to get into the implications of privacy and domestic sort of surveillance. But before that, I sort of want to ask you now about sort of the state of cybersecurity, because in a recent Politico piece, you talked about how cybersecurity surveillance systems were siloed. Information was not, you know, easily shareable between government entities, and a coordination between, you know, these various U.S. departments and agencies was not as high as it could have been. We'd love for you to sort of elaborate on this problem and where we've sort of seen this before in other areas of national security and how it compares to the cyber realm.
Andre, after the horrific attacks of 9/11, a national commission was formed, and one of their foremost conclusions in looking at why we were unable to detect and stop this plot that turned into the 9/11 horrific disaster was that our information within our law enforcement community and the national security community was siloed. And there wasn't adequate information sharing. So the FBI, as we all know, knew something about the hijackers of the aircraft involved in 9/11, but didn't, to use the overworked term, connect the dots with some information available elsewhere. And I think we've seen that same kind of siloed pattern, that inability to connect the dots in our reaction to cybersecurity problems. We have responsibility for cyber dispersed across many entities in the federal government. We have my old agency, the National Security Agency, is clearly at the forefront of that and responsible for cybersecurity for understanding the intentions of foreign adversaries in the cyber world. The NSA itself is also responsible for protecting national security systems, classified networks, the Department of Defense network, contractors, classified networks. But NSA is not responsible for protecting systems of American businesses, nor are they even responsible generally for the networks of the rest of the federal government. That's the responsibility of the Department of Homeland Security. And no government agency is generally responsible for defending private networks. That's responsibility of every private network. So we've got very dispersed responsibilities on the executive branch side. In Congress, it's equally the case. We have some 60-odd committees, as the Cyberspace Solarium Commission recently pointed out, that have some jurisdiction in some way or oversight for cyber. And you know that when 60-odd people are responsible for something, that means no one's really responsible. We have a federal government structure right now with, as I said, a new cyber policy director and officials in the National Security Council responsible, as well as elsewhere in the government. So on the government side, it's dispersed, all for good reasons and legitimate historical legacy reasons. I'm not necessarily saying it's bad, but we need to recognize that is an inefficiency. And then on the private sector side, the private sector is the target of all this. They're the ones that have the most knowledge of what's going on in the world, in the cyber world, and yet their information can't easily be shared, A, among them, in some cases it can, but not broadly, and with the government. And it can't be fused with government information. So what most cybersecurity researchers think we need and most experts in the private sector think we need is some kind of one-stop shopping where the private sector can quickly alert others of cyber anomalies, cyber breaches, cyber attacks that they've seen, get that information into the hands of some kind of government agency, and we could debate which is the right one, but some kind of government agency that takes that information, fuses it with intelligence from the intelligence community, maybe shares some of that intelligence in an unclassified way with the private sector to say, look, be alert that I'm making this up, that Iran is trying to impose ransomware in American hospitals. So the American hospitals would now be on the alert for that or whatever. I'm just making up some example. But we could take two-way sharing of information, do this in a very rapid way, have automated systems look at what's called threat intelligence, these signs of compromise, signs of infection, whether it's domestic or foreign, and then very quickly spit out the answer, disseminate it widely so that individual computer owners will be able to, perhaps even in an automated way, reconfigure their firewalls to block what's now been identified as malware or a malicious website. Cloud providers can instantly stop connections to that malicious website. Maybe someone whose computer has already been infected by this would now have the ability to bottle up the intruder and not permit them to get any farther inside their system. So if we could do this all in a very quick way with two-way information sharing in so-called machine time, we won't be able to stop every attack. That's true. But we'll certainly be able to prevent them from spreading. And boy, that would be a significant achievement.
Absolutely. Information sharing is critical, and the consequences of lapses in communication are very real, and we know what they are. And so, Glenn, thank you for that. I next want to turn to privacy and surveillance. You were the top lawyer at NSA. The U.S. has many tools when it comes to surveillance and monitoring, particularly when it pertains to foreign threats. But there is a rise in domestic threats, right? We've seen a lot of domestic terrorism of late, and I'm curious as to what power the U.S. government has to surveil its citizens, particularly when they're taking part in illegal acts, when they're violating the law.
Sure. Well, you know, on the very first day I joined the National Security Agency, I swore an oath, which I hadn't done in my many, many years of private practice, and that oath was to defend the Constitution. I very much viewed my job every day for almost 5 years at the National Security Agency of not only, of course, to be a good lawyer, but also very much to make sure I was doing everything I could to defend the Constitution. So as it's relevant in the security area, as in the surveillance area, of course, that fundamentally means paying attention to the Fourth Amendment. So we have some very, very important principles in this country established by the Fourth Amendment as it's been interpreted over the 200 odd years by the courts. To draw very, very clear lines about the authority of government relative to American citizens. The Fourth Amendment protects American citizens, whether they're located in the United States or overseas. And certainly at NSA, we were very careful to make sure our intelligence surveillance was focused on foreigners, not Americans. The counterpart to that, the FBI and other agencies in the United States that do have the statutory power to undertake surveillance are limited by the Fourth Amendment, which means basically that if they're going to target an American, they need a search warrant based on probable cause obtained by a judge, et cetera. And I think that distinction is a very, very important one. Obviously, it presents challenges when we are talking about what appear to be the need to do some kind of surveillance in the United States to address domestic surveillance. I am not, and I want to be very clear with this, suggesting that we in any way, shape, or form weaken the Fourth Amendment by even one molecule. But I do think we equally need to recognize that we do have a challenge in the United States, and I think we're going to need to confront that in terms of domestic terrorism and domestic disinformation in a way that's consistent with the Fourth Amendment. I think we've got some tools to do so, but it's going to require some hard work.
So Glenn, I want to spend the closure of this interview sort of talking about how we address these new challenges in national security, these future challenges in national security, because I mean, we've spent so much talking about cyber. It looks like cyber is sort of going to be the future so much. These domestic challenges we're now facing. So how do we transform the intelligence community to meet these current challenges? For example, like, does it mean we have to change what we consider to be national security? Do we need to deal differently with a power like China? Or do we need to have more of a reliance on open source? What's sort of your take on this?
Andre, as you probably know, that historians have a saying that pandemics don't make history, they accelerate it. And I think the recent pandemic, which we're still in the midst of, hopefully coming to the end of it at some point, certainly accelerated a couple of trends that I think are relevant to your question. One of the things that people had been talking about beforehand is that maybe we need to broaden the definition of national security a little bit and make sure our intelligence community focuses on things in addition to worrying about North Korea's nuclear weapons. I mean, we of course have to continue doing that. We have to worry about Iran and all these other countries that wish to do us harm. So I'm not suggesting we take our eye off the ball in that regard, but we need to add to that list of things we need to worry about. And one of those things is clearly threats to our national well-being caused by public health crises. And so the pandemic showed us that we now need to have better intelligence about public health crises. The pandemic also showed us what happens when international trade and supplies, shipping and logistics are disrupted. And we saw how vulnerable our country was, for a number of weeks we couldn't get toilet paper on our supermarket shelves, to something far more significant, which is right now we're running a shortage of semiconductor chips, which is affecting the production of automobiles in Detroit. So the pandemic illustrated these global dependencies that we all sort of knew about, but really became so manifest when there were disruptions in these global dependencies. So I think this shows us that our national well-being, largely due to technology, is now so globally intertwined with so many interdependencies that we can't just say, "Oh, national security is worrying about Russian and North Korean missiles or Chinese submarines." So we need to broaden the definition of national security. That has significant implications for our intelligence community, which did a great job after the Cold War of containing communism. And with very clear adversaries. And after 9/11, we pivoted to dealing with the problem of international terrorism, extremism. But we haven't yet really made the change to addressing this far broader definition of national security, which I think our intelligence community must now focus on. That's going to require greater collaboration with the private sector, with academia. The intelligence community does not have experts on crop genetics resident inside the intelligence community. I mean, maybe they have some, but it's certainly not a center of excellence. That's probably in the Department of Agriculture. So if we really want to understand the threat posed by China's experimentation with crop genetics and understand what the significance of that is going to mean for global food supplies, our intelligence community is going to need to have access to that information, either because it will have that expertise inside, or we'll go outside to academia, or purchase it, or rely on the Department of Agriculture. But I'm using that as one example, but that's all largely new to our intelligence community. I'm sure they can rise to the occasion. I'm not being in any way being critical of them, but I'm just saying that is the task that is in front of us. So that's just one illustration of how we're going to have a much broader definition. Climate change is another one that leaps to mind. Will have very, very profound effects. And our intelligence community and decision makers are going to have really solid information on which to base decisions in the future about that.
Well, what a perfect way to end this fantastic conversation. Glenn, I want to thank you for joining us and, of course, for your service to this country. Your insights are incredibly valuable. And for all of our listeners, Glenn is very active in speaking and writing on all of these issues we discuss and many more issues. And so please check out the episode description for a link to his website. Glenn, once again, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ryan and Andre. I've enjoyed it, and I hope your listeners have as well. And thank you so much for this great opportunity.